Blog Talk Radio.
Bringing voices to power. I do not own the rights to this music. Bringing voices to power network.
You know, healthcare, I didn't put that on there. That's another hot topic.
www.thechildsupporthustle.com. Catch the Child Support Hustle Show Saturdays on the Bringing the Voices to Power Network. United Voices with Sherry Saunders. EmpoweringStrategies.net. Child Support Hustle Show with Kenya Rockman. We're bringing voices to power. With many other activists like Brenda Hampton in Corlin, Alabama, we're bringing awareness to the people.
All right, in this episode of the Grassroots Mouthpiece Show, I'm going to be talking with Alabama Senate District 7 candidate Deborah Barros. District 7 serves Huntsville, Hazel Green, Meridianville, Moores Mill, and Redstone Arsenal. We will talk about the many things that she supports, such as increasing the minimum wage, criminal justice, and correctional reforms, and restorative justice programs in our schools, and also a cleaner, greener Alabama utilizing water, wind, and solar, and the reclassification of marijuana possession from a felony to a fine, among a few other things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about some other hot-button issues that she has in mind as well. Good morning, Ms. Barros. How's it going?
As I tell people, I'm blessed and highly favored. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good. I can't complain. Tell us a little bit about your campaign. First of all, I like to always ask all the candidates, what was the point that made you feel like you had to get into politics, you had to run for office? Because everybody has that point where something says, you know, I got to make that move.
That's true. For me, I had originally started running for governor. A lot of people will remember that. A couple of years ago, I had started kicking off that campaign. And then what got me into that was saying, you know, I'm sick and tired of being the laughing stock as far as Alabama is concerned. And then I kept meeting a lot of people that needed help with things. However, they couldn't get what they needed. They didn't feel like their rights were protected. And I had some other people saying, you've worked with politics and campaigns for a long time. You've been civilly engaged for a long time in the community. Why don't you run? So I said, okay, you know, I'll go for the top because that's how I was raised. However, as time went on, I decided when a lot of things in life was happening, life was getting in the way. And when that happens, I tell people you deal with life. So I had a lot of things going on, including my grandmother declining. I had a grandchild I'm excited about, the cutest and the best grandson in the world was on his way. It was just a lot going on. And I stepped down. And then I had some people say, you know, we need you. You still need to be. They were very disappointed that I had stepped down. And then one day I got a call from Commissioner Bob Harrison, who's now deceased, and he said he had just found out that Paul Sanford was not running. And he told me that he was glad that I had stepped down from the governor's race, that now was not my time. But he believed that this running for Senate, that I could do that. And so with that being said, I thought about it, prayed about it, talked to my family. And my grandmother, who I've been fighting for so long for things, told me, go for it. And so I did. I decided to be the voice for the people that didn't have a voice or didn't feel like they could have a voice. So with that being said, I stepped on in and decided to go ahead and run for the Senate position, for the state Senate position.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I just like to ask everybody that because there's always something that triggers, you know, people want to go into public service. Now, tell us a little bit, what's your ideas on, first thing I want to ask you about is school safety. What do you stand on that?
Well, you know, I believe that when we talk about school safety, we're not just talking about children. We're talking about the teachers, the aides, and any other staff. We need to understand that as parents. I know when my son was in school that I sent him to school thinking that he would be safe. That has been the norm for years. No matter what we've gone through in this country, we knew that our children would be safe in school, okay? We know that things are happening. However, in this day and time now, we want to focus on the guns in school, and I'm very much a proponent of gun sense is common sense. And I've just recently got the Moms Demand Action gun sense or gun common sense distinction as a candidate, and I was very proud of that. However, when I turn around and I look at children that are struggling in school, it's not just with academics. We have children that are scared to go to school every day because they're being bullied. We still have, whether folks want to believe it or not, hazing in our middle to high schools. We know this because in Mobile, a family is suing that school system for their child being hazed. And then we worry about children knowing that some of their friends are gang members and they come in and they sometimes have weapons. We have teachers that are afraid of students in their classrooms right here in Madison County, in Huntsville. You have teachers that are afraid of some of the children in their classrooms. And so
You even saying that, and we'll get back to your answer on that in a minute, but I don't like the sound of that, even though, however true, you know, there's something we got to be doing in our communities and in our homes, too, where we have kids that threatening out in society going to these schools. I mean.
Well, you know, you may not want to believe it, but go back a couple of years. We have a school, a elementary school in Huntsville, where the teachers had reported it was undercover, somewhat anonymous, on the media, where they were showing bruises on themselves. And at that time, the superintendent made the comment that he didn't believe it was true, because when he walks in the school, all the children would run up and hug him. And then somebody
superintendent.
Right? But then somebody videotaped it and saw how the children were acting. And that was in just that school. Now let's move up to the middle and high school.
You're correct. You're correct. That can happen, but we also need to be very guarded against those outside forces. Some people want to militarize school, and they'll take normal child kid stuff. Yes, you can be wrestling around with a kid that's resistant and get bruised, but the full scope of what happened in that incident a lot of times don't get told. You just see the after effects. And yes, we need to be on the watch for a bruise showing up on a teacher or bus driver or whomever. Many times the reaction does not fit. Many times there is an overreaction. And like I said, all this stuff begins at home, number one. Number two, some of these incidents, people are using that as a pretext to militarize the schools, to start scarring younger and younger kids' records and help that prison, the school-to-prison pipeline. We got to be careful of
that,
too.
That's right. And I agree, and I'm not interested in militarizing schools. But in this situation, the teachers had been complaining about situations, and also in that situation, at that time, you had a lot of teachers that were actually scared of the superintendent for their jobs. And behind situations like this, you had many teachers quitting. We have got to understand that we may not want to face the harsh reality of some things happening. I've always been a mentor, a tutor, and a supporter of young people. I love young people. I've done it since I was 15 years old in a group called Pathfinding, teaching kids how to camp. But what I try to tell people is this: you're right, it starts at home. You're right. But we have some parents that don't want to admit that little Susie and little Joey is a problem. We have school systems that make it hard to have children be suspended that crosses the line. And you do have some teachers that do get afraid for whatever reason,
some of them do get afraid, and a lot of that afraidness and
it's
fear
cultural.
Also. Yes, it's
a
cultural.
Lot of,
It's cultural. They might not be used to black kids, might not be used to white kids. You know, they don't have enough cultural training, and they see something outside of what their culture does, then all of a sudden it's abnormal. Let's go get the medicine. Let's suspend them. Let's do this and let's do that.
Right.
There's not enough social training given to all teachers, not just one particular race of teachers, but all teachers. There's a lot of
that's right.
Because they haven't hardly grown up without being around themselves. So that type of teaching needs to be done.
I think too many kids are labeled with ADHD. I think that too many kids
are
labeled with ADHD.
Listen, when they label these kids ADHD, which is, I like to say after Dr. Johnson says, ADHD ain't nothing but ain't no daddy at home disorder. That's what he calls it. But on another note, they get huge sums of money. This is school district welfare that they get when they label these kids ADHD and when they put them in these special education programs. Those are the big bucks. And the more kids
can
label that, the more money more welfare, education welfare that these school districts can get. And another problem with it is the classrooms, that there's not enough teachers. The classrooms are so
big.
Or
they're too big.
If
the
kid doesn't get it, they're going to be sent out to special ed or something's going to happen. They're going to move on. They don't have time to move on. I mean, they don't have time to stop and make sure out of 20 people in this classroom that these three people or two people over here is just a little bit behind. They don't have time for that. They got to keep moving, so it's best just to get that child out of the way.
Right.
That is one of our problems that we got. They can get them out of the way and
that's
keep
it.
Moving, plus get an extra benefit of that education welfare for the district. It's a sad
that's
situation.
It. That's
and,
it. And, you know, and
also,
and
what did,
I
you
was...
know too, did you also know, too, that that's why you see a lot of these organizations involved with the schools that's dishing out all this, like Wellstone and other places that's dishing out these medications. When these schools suggest that the child sees this and that counselor, then that counselor or the school in some cases recommend that this child get on medication, that's also big bucks. Not just being in the
that's
system,
right.
but if you have one in the system that's also prescribe some of these ADHD medicines you're talking about, that's when you would get more and more of these cases. But there has been schools that shown that they are beating ADHD with more recess time. I know these kids got to learn, they got to get it, you know, but they're beating ADHD with more recess time, not medication. The recess time is doing better than medication.
You know, Marcus, when I started this and I was talking about some teachers are scared of children, you know, it's various reasons why that is. But a lot of these kids also know, because I've had kids tell me what they're going to do. They can't touch me. They can't hit me. So they can do whatever they want. They can
that's
tell us,
part,
hit me and watch me go get my mom.
That's the part about the kids at home. That's the part
that's
that begins
it.
At home.
That's it. But even with that, when we talk about safety in school, we have to look at the whole big picture, okay? And my thing is, now that hot topic is giving guns to teachers, well, I have a friend who said we should arm teachers with livable wages, safer classrooms, better funding, and low student-to-teacher ratios, not guns. We need to arm them with the extra cultural training. We need to arm them with, as I said, livable wages, but I'm going to say higher wages, because my hope is that if we can do what we're supposed to do by our teachers and not give them higher wages, but then raise their insurance so they never see it in their checks, then when we put the call out, we need teachers, we'll get the best teachers to apply and we'll be able to hold on to them. Safety isn't just about violence and fighting. It's about coming to some harsh reality.
And you are 100% correct. It's about paying these teachers more, because if you're going to get a teaching degree in Alabama, you're not going to make no money unless you leave Alabama. So big shouts out to all the teachers that stayed in Alabama, you know, with less pay, because they believe in it is what they do. We have to pay these teachers. These teachers are not getting paid enough. So as a senator, how strong of an advocate would you be for raising pay among our teachers?
Oh, you know what? I am a strong advocate, because I've been a substitute teacher. I've been a collegiate instructor teacher. I've run programs on a college level. I have friends that are teachers, family members that were teachers. I understand the awesome responsibility. And what I tell people is this: for every professional, every wealth, every whatever it is you have in this country, doctor, lawyer, Indian chief, it was a teacher that helped get them there. And when I look at some of these professions that are making much more money than what our teachers and our other emergency personnel are getting, it bothers me. And I feel that your child is with a teacher longer in the day than they are with you. You may have them on weekends and nights, but those teachers become the surrogate parents in their classrooms. So whatever reason that they don't feel safe, you know, I don't care. They need that support. And if it's training, they need that. And then I have to look at my children and say they should be coming into a classroom where they feel safe. They should go to school. It should be a conducive learning experience. You know, we even have to encourage the teachers to be even more creative in their classroom. And I say by using a multidisciplinary approach, okay? We, our schools should find innovative ways of partnering even more so with professionals and colleges and government agencies, bringing speakers and mentors even more so. And especially with the financial shortfalls that our school systems have, especially in Alabama, okay? We've eliminated programs like music and arts. And we talk about the STEM program, and that's very good. But we also need to bring back some of the things that we got rid of. I know when I was coming up, we looked up to our teachers. And I know that if I acted up, my teacher was going to call home. And when I got home, I knew there was going to be trouble. When my son was growing up, I would go meet with the teacher every year before school started, ask them what did they expect of me, what did they expect of my son, and then I tell them what I expected of them. And if you had to speak to my son twice, on the third time, you called me or his dad, and we would be down at the school, and you wouldn't have that problem anymore. So, okay, we need more engagement of parents. Now, there are parents out there that are very engaged, and then there's some that they don't know what's going on in the school system. So, I look at all that. But then I also look at the state's Accountability Act. I don't agree with that. There's a need to replace the millions of dollars that are taken from our public school system, okay, throughout Alabama. And that also leads to a shortage of qualified teachers because of low wages. Our teachers deserve so much better. And I am very supportive of our teachers, because if it wasn't for teachers, I know my son and my daughter-in-law wouldn't be out there doing what they're doing. I wouldn't be running. Now, I grant you, I had strong women in my life, you know, like my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, and my great-grandmother, and I still have strong women in my life, my aunties now. But I also know that it was teachers that got them where they were. It was teachers that got me where I am. And I saw on Facebook one day somebody was saying, do you remember your fourth grade teacher? A lot of people didn't. Oh, I remembered mine. I remembered my teacher. And up until she was deceased, whenever I saw her, I was hugging and kissing her, because I know what she did for me. So, no, I think that we owe the most respect, the utmost respect for our teachers. But they've got to feel safe. The kids have got to feel safe. And so, no, we don't need to arm our teachers with guns. We need to give them livable, good wages. Their classrooms should be conducive to learning. And we need to teach our teachers, and some of them do, so when I say this, I'm not saying all don't, how to teach on every learning style so that every child could learn. Because sometimes the child you think has ADHD may have a different learning style and are just totally bored in school.
You hear me?
So, yep, that's what we need to do. We need to look
at
all of
this. That's exactly what we need to do. And see, that's why I said we need smaller classrooms and teachers. Not a knock on teachers, but they need more creative ways of reaching some students. You know, because a lot of kids that they try to label as ADHD and all this other stuff, they have other gifts. But the teacher, like I said, because she's got a big classroom, she doesn't have time to focus in on that kid's specialty. Every kid can learn, and every kid has a strength, and we need to be able to focus on strengths.
Let me tell you, when my son was We were living out in the county in Harvest, and the school that my son went to, he had good grades. And then all of a sudden, his grades started dropping. So I went up to the school, and I asked for his teacher, and I found out that was no longer his teacher, that they had put him in the same grade but in another classroom. And the classroom they put him in were more lower-functioning students. So now my son started goofing off because he didn't like to be teased that he was so smart. His grades dropped, dropping, and he didn't have students, classmates that he could compete with. Well, I hit the roof. Why you move my child out of this classroom? I mean, why? Why? I mean, I didn't say put all low-functioning kids in one class, but why did you move my child and then want to contact me or I got to come here about his behavior and his grades? Well, number one, I got on the school. I made them put him back. And then I got on my son because he had to learn a lesson that you always be your best in spite of. His grades picked back up. His behavior got better. And the teachers knew that all they had to do was call me and I would handle it. You know, we have got to stop labeling kids. We have got to stop saying certain things in front of kids.
We got to stop labeling kids. Now, I got paddlings in school. I know they don't want to do that. But there's also an element and I studied psychology and sociology, what I went to college for, and I worked in it and ran a facility of teenagers. But we have got to get back to some type of discipline. You should be able to, if a kid's acting out doing something, they should be able to call one of the parents. They should have a room where the parent can go in there and discipline that kid on the spot. If they don't want to give them a paddling, they should be able to let the parents do it. But we live in a society where some of these organizations and government organizations like Child Protective Services, DHR, stuff like that, and some of the psychology magazines, they don't believe in physical discipline at all. Call me old school, and I'm not a religious fanatic. It's in the Bible, but you spare the rod. But I think you should be able to discipline your kids, not to hurt them, but it's in your nature to do that when they're very young. If you do that when they're very young in a responsible way, you can cure a lot of this stuff going on in schools. But people are afraid to discipline their kids. Just like that kid told you, what is the kid going to do? These kids know these parents can't do too much. They can pick up the phone, call DHR, see anything. And the DHR stand to make money, too, because if they yank that kid out, boom, there's over $15,000 they're going to get automatically to get that child placed and get them situated.
You're right. Because like you, our principals paddled us, but they brought the teachers in. And if it was a girl, they had the female teacher. If it was a boy, it was the male teacher. But they never took our clothes off. They never fondled us. And they only gave like three little pops with a little paddle. And, you know, and I knew that when I got home, I was going to get another paddle. But, you know, I just think it is time that we look at school safety as an integrated approach and not in the manner in which we are now, where we're talking preventing violence. We have to. Because, see, I don't have a problem in this day and age. I don't have a problem with a metal detector at entrances. Nobody says
no,
you gotta have to be looking like military. They should have cameras on the outside and cameras on the inside. I mean, you know, we can't look at what you and I went through last year. We have to look at what our kids are going through this year. And you know, I used to sit down with my son and ask him, do you have any gang members in your school? You know, a lot of parents don't even have meals with their kids. They don't ask it. I would ask my son, how many girls in your school are pregnant? You need to know what's going on in your child's life. Now, the other issue I have is that we need to change the common practice of cutting off education when our autistic kids age out of school, okay? They may age out, but autism does not end when a person turns 21. And these young
right.
adults need support, and many of their parents, because I have a friend that said, what am I going to do? Because I'm married and bought a house, they have nothing for my child. You know, they need our support, the parents. The public school system should send an aid to homes or open up special programs for continuing education for these adults, because they spent all their life going through what we call as close to normalcy as possible. And no matter what your Attorney General Jeff Sessions says, our special needs kids are not a blot on society. They are special to their families. They're special to me. I work with them every day. And they're used to going to school, interacting and learning. And then suddenly they're aged out and it's taken away. And what's offered is 3 to 5 years waiting list. And then the other things they have is like they just go there and sit around, okay? So there has to be developed a traditional adult program to get these young people and their parents ready for the adult life. Now, Alabama has one of the highest rates of autism in the country, okay? And it's going to be up to us to take the lead and change the broken system that I say snatches away that structure and purpose that our autistic great young people have, and offer them and their parents to need the much needed support that they need. Now, I discussed that along with school safety because there is a lot of bullying. Now, we have some bullying programs in Alabama and we have laws for it, but we need to go back and relook at it because I have a coworker who's talking about how her daughter was bullied almost on a daily basis and she couldn't get any help. And so whether you have an autistic child or not, that's a safety issue. And that's why I say school safety needs to be looked at as an integrated approach, because you can have a child feeling unsafe and bullied just by words. And so I am, like I said, very supportive of education reform, which I think needs to be included school bus safety. Being in school bus transportation, I see at firsthand the things that are going on that don't get addressed like it should be. And I tell everybody it's from a financial standpoint, you know, and people need to step up, as I always say, stand up, use their voice. And, you know, let me say this, and some people are going to take this the wrong way. I didn't have a problem standing up fighting for the name change for Johnson High School because that was historical. But what I had a problem with, nobody was asking why they wanted to put hormonal middle schoolers on the same campus with hormonal high schoolers, and nobody was talking about how to get the schools off the failing list. We spent so much time on that issue, we forgot the other issues that should have been included with it. So I, when it comes to education, I'm a believer of education, of all levels of education, and I believe that we should take care of our teachers and our children and the rest of the staff at the schools.
Okay, let me get some. We got a few more minutes left. Let me ask you something else. That's another hot topic that's been talked about, and across the country and very growing steadily in Alabama, is ask you about marijuana. I mean, you in favor, against, favor for recreational, in favor of medicinal? What do you stand on that? How would you want voters to know?
First of all, I think it's going to be a process on how it is dealt with. I think we need to start with reclassifying the marijuana laws from a felony to a fine. So let's just start with that one first. We got overcrowded prisons. And I know that in our overcrowded prisons, we are not, we don't have, most of them are not marijuana quote-unquote felons. Okay, however, that's just another way of trying to help to release some of that overcrowding. And then we have, I was at the Attorney General Forum, the candidates for running for Attorney General, and one of them said that they had heard about a young man that just finished serving 9 years in prison for smoking marijuana. Really? I tell people, before you judge about marijuana, go back to prohibition.
And learn about
Remember how prohibition, they didn't want cigarettes or alcohol, so the crimes were high because the people were selling it illegally and people were drinking it and smoking. Okay, we then got rid of prohibition and made alcohol and cigarettes legal. But the problem is, alcohol, you got all these DUI groups and everybody talking about somebody was killed because of the DUI, somebody driving under the influence. You have cigarettes, which they've had to put warning labels on the packages saying can cause cancer. People have sued cigarette companies and won millions. But at no time, and I'm not going to say it didn't happen, but at no time have I heard somebody was driving under the influence of marijuana and crashed and killed the family, or the marijuana created brain damage or lung cancer. So we do know that there are some things that marijuana does help with, and the list is longer than people realize it. And so I definitely support marijuana for medicinal purposes, okay? Couldn't get that word out. But then
okay, let me ask you
this.
Yeah, I was going to ask you one very important thing. I want to get this in here, too. Another hot topic that's talked about in the grassroots. I had to feel like I had to bring these issues out to people tell me to ask is, tell us what your stance on the lottery. There's a lot of talk about the lottery. How do you feel about that?
Well, here again, you know, this is a topic that people judge, just like marijuana. Oh, my. You know, look, let me say one more thing on marijuana. You got a lot of farmers that are losing their farms and their lands, okay, with everything that's going on in this country. They can't take care of their family. What if you told
right,
a farmer?
A lot of them are not going to be able to take care of their families also, too, because of the new tariff that Trump is trying to slap on China. So a lot of people have canceled their orders of American soybeans to sort of hit back at Trump and the people in
that's
the heartland.
It.
Hey,
that's
we
it.
Can fight China back with him. He
that's
can
it.
Do anything that soy can do, and it's a whole lot better for you than soy. So these farmers, like you
and
said,
the big winners
in Alabama. The big winners in Alabama, if hemp and marijuana were to go legal, would be the farmers first and then the landowners.
That's it. But not only that, Marcus, the areas that have marijuana legalized, that they actually have stores now, those stores can't keep it on the shelves. And just imagine if one farmer in Alabama grew it, do what you're supposed to do. I don't pretend to know the process. And could sell it just outside the state by itself, he'd probably make $1 million in a year. You know, people usually want to know, how does this affect my pocket? And then there was a black lady, I think in Colorado, right when they legalized it, she was one of the first ones to open up a store. And she's one of the first millionaires. I mean, and it's not all about money, but if it's taking care of the economy and putting the money in the economy, if you legalize it and tax, and legalization and taxation, that's millions coming into the economy. Now, I personally, before somebody say I do, I mean, I don't. I've never liked the smell of it. I've never wanted to use it. I don't use it. But I see where we can help people. Why put someone, label someone as a felon, and then when they come out of prison for marijuana, now they can't get jobs? That's another recidivism. Now they can't have pride to take care of their family because they were young and smoked a few joints and got busted. So, okay, so we're looking at it from financially in Alabama with the prison system.
And like
which
you said,
you know,
they can't keep it. They can't keep it on the shelf. I was just reading something this morning on Forbes, and you can go to Forbes.com and check me out on this. marijuana demand in the U.S. is now it's now in more demand than ice cream. We know we eat a lot of ice cream, but in this summertime, but marijuana is in more demand than ice cream at this time of the year. And that goes back to say that the people who stand to gain the most if Alabama was to decriminalize, and we would say every taxpayer would save money if we did decriminalize it because we wouldn't be paying for all these super prisons
right.
they want to build.
That's it.
And also, what about all these, they would help the health care. The health care.
I say,
like me and you discussed, and when we was riding on when we went to Montgomery for this speech, when we discussed those things we were talking about, that you and I both were talking about we need legalization, regulation, taxation, education, and health care. Think about everything that they're treating people with cannabis. So that's going to help Alabama's health care crisis. You're going to help that. You're going to free up these prisons. And it's just so much benefit to it that the only reason why they're not doing it is to make the money from the prison system.
That's right. And we all know that the prison system is big money, and that's why they keep talking about privatization and all of that. But, so if we say that, and the reason I went back to this, I'm going to the lottery, is because I tell people, I just don't stand up and say what we need to do. I try to figure out ways to, if we need to do something, to bring the money in to do it. So if you want to help with health care, if you want to help take care of families financially, if there's so much that you can do that just from the legalization and taxation of marijuana, that it would help because you would bring now billions in, okay? Then we want to talk about education and lottery, and the lottery is a hot topic. Someone told me, you're just contributing to the moral turpitude of people talking about marijuana and education. I'm like, no, because it doesn't matter what I say. If they're going to smoke marijuana, they're going to smoke marijuana. It doesn't matter what I say. People are going across three state lines spending millions of dollars in other states that legalize the lottery. And what are those states doing? They are paying for their kids' education. They're paying for their elderly. They're taking care of their business, and we in Alabama is footing it for them. So my thing is, it doesn't matter if we legalize it or don't. People are going to do it. So what Deborah says will not cause somebody to go down the wrong road of despair. But if we legalized it in Alabama, we keep it here. We keep the money here. And if we can bring in over $1 million a year, and probably more than that, because you do have some people that play it but don't play it all the time because they – not because they don't want to get up the money, but because of transportation. Now, somebody said if they can spend money on the lottery, they don't need food stamps. That's not true. If you put a budget together and somebody goes down and spends $2 or $10 – on a lottery ticket, that's not making or breaking a budget. But the thing is, it's their choice and right to do that. So why are you taking money?
Let me jump in here. I want you to tell the listeners and potential voters out there how they can help your campaign and how they can contact you.
You can, number one, I'm in a primary. And primaries are hard in raising funds. In order for me to do what I need to do to go closer to becoming that Senate by winning that primary on June 5th, I need you to vote. But even before that time, I need people to donate. Donate every little bit helps. And people say everything is about money, but I'm here to tell you cannot run a campaign without money. If anybody in this area have seen my wonderful bright yellow signs, they were not cheap. I need more signs. I need more. Everywhere I go, I'm handing out materials. Anybody asks me to go anywhere, I go. I don't care how far it is. If I can fit it in my schedule and nothing else is going, I'm going to go. That's gas. We need funding. Now is the time to donate. And you can donate through my website, which is www.VoteDeborahBarros.com. That's www.VoteDeborahBarros.com. And you can donate. And